A warning to our listeners. This episode contains strong language.
Previously on Looking for the Tote Family.
First of all, I am 10,000% innocent of all these preposterous charges. I love my wife still very deeply, and it will be the hardest thing to sit there and tell everyone that it was her that did this when I was not home. If I was there that night, this never would have happened.
From the day in New London, Connecticut, I'm Taylor Hartz.
And I'm Sten Spinella.
And this is Looking for the Tote Family.
Turns out it was a Benadryl pudding pie.
In the last episode, we heard the first half of a 27-page letter Tony Tote wrote from jail to his estranged father, Robert. In that first half, Tony says he is 10,000% innocent of the crimes he is accused of committing. He says he came home from falling asleep in his car to find the remnants of a pie on his kitchen table. A pie, he says, had been laced with Benadryl. In this episode, you'll hear one of our producers, Carlos Virgen, reading the rest of the letter.
I went to the bathroom downstairs to pee, newly diagnosed with diabetes 2 that is well under control now. Passing the TV that was on ESPN talking about college football, normal as Alec and I always had some sort of sports bet. This one was about Joe Burrows from LSU going number one. I thought he would be, in addition to being a Heisman winner, and he thought Jalen Hurts from Oklahoma, Alabama, due to his resume and diversity. If I won, he had to eat a pepperoni pizza. If he won, I had to eat a seafood dish of his choosing. Not raw, but he promised there would be a lot of tentacles. He and I were buds, but he always competed against me. I followed the Yankees, so of course he had to be a Red Sox fan, etc. Sorry for the length of the letter, but I thought, since Chrissy brought you into this, I guess they were looking for me. And because you contacted the Hartford Courant for that article, you should be told the details. I would have called a press conference months ago, but I was told by my attorneys, who happen to be some of the best in the state, that that was not the appropriate way to handle the case.
According to court records, Tony hasn't hired a private attorney. He's been appointed a public defender by the court.
So I just sit in idle, making a list of lawsuits when I get out. In addition, I'm writing this letter on recommendation of the chaplain. I'll explain later. Anyways, I came out of the bathroom and found Meg at the top of the stairs. I ran to her, ready to explain why I wasn't there. She started tearing and smiling, saying, "You are alive. They didn't get you." I was confused and saw her wearing my gray HydroWorks shirt, and there was a stain on it. I asked her what was going on, if the kids reminded her where I was, where were the kids, and if everything was okay. She said the kids were fine, and everything was okay now that I was there. She led me into the bedroom and began telling me about her vision she got yesterday while meditating, telling her the end of the world was beginning with virus attack and eventual invasion. I was captured and going to be killed, and she was granted salvation with the boys once their souls were released.
Tony says Megan told him that she had a vision about the world ending by way of a virus attack. It's worth mentioning that we've been investigating this case in the midst of a global pandemic. According to the medical examiner, Megan died around the end of December. The first cases of COVID-19 were reported to the World Health Organization on December 31st, 2019. Based on the information we have, it's likely Megan died without knowing about the coronavirus pandemic.
Because she was sicker than we all realize, this vision was telling her she would not be strong enough to survive.
Megan allegedly told Tony she was surprised to see him alive. She said that in her vision, she and the boys had been granted salvation. In order to reach that salvation, she allegedly had to release their souls. Tony doesn't mention Megan talking about Zoe or Breezy, though, who were also found dead in the home. When the bodies were found, it was clear that Megan, Alec, and Tyler had all died the same way. They had ingested Benadryl and had been stabbed in their stomachs. But the ME ruled that Zoe had not been stabbed. When I talked to the medical examiner after the autopsy reports were published, he said that although there was no clear evidence of a stab wound on Zoe, she might have been stabbed too, They just might not have been able to tell because of how much her body had decomposed by the time they found her. The medical examiner also told me that the family's dog, Breezy, had been stabbed multiple times. In all the phone calls and letters we reviewed from Tony, he never mentions Breezy. In Tony's account of that morning, he says the murders took place after Megan had a vision while meditating.
She had turned more and more spiritual over the last few years for guidance due to the illness. I can write a whole book on it. I didn't really believe in it, but whatever made her feel better, as long as no sacrifices, etc. I supported her.
This mention of sacrifices stood out to us as we tried to decipher this letter. Tony, always describing himself as a supportive husband, says that he fully supported Megan's spiritual journey, just as long as there were no sacrifices. What exactly was Megan involved in that no sacrifices was a ground rule the couple needed to lay? This isn't the first time we've wondered whether some sort of doomsday conspiracy played a role in these murders.
Earlier on in our reporting, we also heard a strange reference to Megan's apocalyptic visions from Chrissy. She called the Osceola County Sheriff's Office on December 29th of 2019 and January 11th of 2020. In the second call, she said there had been a few developments since the first call.
There's actually an active FBI investigation that's happening up here in Connecticut. And I, just in conversations with my sister, you know, my sister-in-law was making a comment about, and we just kind of put it all together, about basically the world ending on the 28th, and nobody has talked to them. Nobody physically talked to my sister-in-law since the 26th of December, and my brother has stopped texting as of Monday.
Long story short, she gave them the Benadryl Tylenol PM pie, separated them, woke up at 11:30, stabbed all of them, suffocated each one. At the news of this, I ran to the bathroom and puked. I was weak. She continued to tell me what happened and then wanted to pray, meditate together. I needed to see my kids. When I went in, I was horrified. It was peaceful, no sign of struggle, as she said, but I didn't believe her that there wasn't a struggle. I got a warm washcloth and wiped each of their faces, held them, cried, and worked to make them look more comfortable by closing their mouths, eyes, and loosening their nasal passages. It was normal for me to wash their faces when they weren't well.
What was hard for me to understand is why Tony spent so little time with his dead children in the letter. There's very little description in an exceedingly descriptive letter of him crying over their bodies or a moment of intense grief upon discovering them. He just says he cried and held them. He doesn't linger on it. There is only the matter-of-fact understanding that they are gone and they were good while they were here. The most brutal and unnerving part of this whole story, to me, and I think to many others, is the three children whose lives were senselessly cut short. But Tony doesn't spill much ink about finding them and reckoning with what had to be a traumatic moment.
Throughout that whole time, Meg kept checking on me very calmly and asking if I was okay while drinking something. Turns out the Benadryl she had been stockpiling for a while. I would respond to her, "No, you murdered our children." And she would respond, "Relax and believe in what I saw. I released their souls." She was calm, oriented, and with it throughout. It still amazes me this day. She had told me earlier she researched this for a while in case it would happen, on websites Quora or Quoria.com and Reddit.com. When I returned to the bedroom, I demanded the phones, as I did not know where they were. She claimed she had hidden them and not to worry, but have faith. She gave me an empty family-sized liquid Benadryl to throw away in the garbage bag she had in the tub, and I took the opportunity to look there for the phones.
Tony says that Megan handed him a bottle of Benadryl to throw away. The state's attorney's office provided us with dozens of photos from the crime scene, and in a few of those photos, there's an empty 4-ounce bottle of Walgreens brand Benadryl and two empty packages of Benadryl pills that investigators found in a trash can outside the house. Another photo shows a substance the same color as Benadryl tablets, crushed into the carpet near the beds where the bodies were found.
Upon going back into the bedroom, I heard a horrific sound of something rubbing a latex balloon. She had stabbed herself the first time. I ran to her bedside, and she said, "Please don't leave me alone to die, as I didn't leave the kids to die alone. When I pull this knife, it will go quick. I can feel it happening now." Before I could react, the knife was pulled and thrown on the bed someplace. There was blood, a lot of blood. I begged her to let me call. I would take all responsibility, as I felt it was all my fault. I'll explain. After a while, nothing happened. She had more of her drink and asked me to leave her for a few minutes, as I was stressing her out with all my pleading of asking her to go for help, where phones were, etc. I took the opportunity to look in the boys' room for a phone in their hiding spaces. I couldn't go to the neighbors as, one, I would violate the agreement of not leaving her alone. Irrational, I know. And two, where we lived, neighbors were never home due to work or mostly snowbirding.
Tony cites his commitment to Megan as the reason for pretty much everything. On the healthcare fraud, he was just a figurehead whose name was on the accounts. Megan really controlled the money. It's the same thing when he's talking about the murders. Not only did Megan kill their children, he says, but she stabbed herself. Why not get help? Well, part of the reason is Megan asked him not to. He says he knows it sounds irrational, but Megan simply asking Tony not to go and tell authorities or neighbors of the horrors that had taken place because she wanted him to stay by her while she died was enough.
I heard the shower on, toilet flush, and sink running. Somehow she was up. When I returned to the bedroom, she again was pounding another family-size liquid Benadryl and gave me the empty bottle to throw away. I took the opportunity to look for the phones again. I asked her where all the Benadryl was, and she said in the linen closet, a place I never went. And I looked there also, no phones.
Tony tells us in the first part of this letter that Megan was so sick that he would often have to bathe her, dress her, and even carry her up to bed. Yet here, he says that she had the strength to plunge a knife into herself, and then get up, walk around, go into the bathroom and run the sink and shower, flush the toilet, and then come back into the bedroom and stab herself again.
As I went back to the bedroom, I saw Meg on the bed holding the knife still on her abdomen, saying, "This one is out of principle," as she pushed the knife into her liver. She pulled it out and dropped it on the bed as I ran to her. I said, "Let me get help. I will take all responsibility for this. My mother, father, sisters, and your grandparents will take care of you." She responded, "I have to be with my babies. Please pray Grandma doesn't find out I killed the kids. It will kill her." Her grandmother was very, very close to me, and I knew this also, especially with the troubled family history on that side of the family. She then put my hand on a pillow that she had put on her face and said, "Please help me pass. I'm in pain 10 times greater than childbirth, and I can't breathe." I said I couldn't, and she pleaded and pulled my hand in her face. I couldn't watch and just left it there. Many moments later, she began hitting my arm, pulling it harder on her face, and then pushing it away as she was saying something. I thought she had changed her mind. "Nope," she said. "I finally found something you suck at. I can still breathe."
Something we're still trying to figure out is how Megan was able to hold this dramatic, meaningful, even comical dialogue with Tony after she had been stabbed and after Tony had tried to suffocate her with a pillow. The "one thing you're not good at" line was also upsetting. Even in the most overwrought TV drama, I'd be shocked to hear this kind of back and forth with someone on the brink of death. It's also another example, as we've seen throughout the letter, of Tony, for lack of a better term, bragging about his physical fitness, his medical know-how, his abilities as a father and a husband. The only thing he's not good at, his dying wife says, according to him, is killing. That conclusion feels a little on the nose coming from someone writing a letter from jail.
According to the autopsy reports, Megan had 2 stab wounds that sunk 8 inches deep into her abdominal cavity at a downward angle. One was on the right side of her stomach, and one was on the left. After both of these stab wounds were inflicted, Tony says Megan was still talking, and that she took his hands and forced him to smother her with a pillow. There was no mention of any smothering or suffocation in Megan's autopsy report.
I told her I couldn't do it, and she pleaded. I started praying for the strength and the balls to do it. She died before I could help her. I couldn't do it. Moments later, she began breathing. I know now, reflex. And I said, I'll ask for forgiveness later, and tried CPR until I physically couldn't anymore. This was the final act of my chapter of failures. I failed as a father. I wasn't there to protect my children, the thing I blame you the most for, and I'm no better. I failed as a husband. I wasn't able to fix Meg or find someone that could, and I wasn't able to succeed in CPR administration. 3 times previous, I was successful on patients, but the person that means the most to me, I failed on. I wanted to die to be with my family, and also I felt I didn't deserve to live. After I cleaned up the kitchen, per request of Meg, I moved the children into our room onto their mattresses in comfortable sleeping positions with a pillow, covered them for warmth and protection, and put a rosary in each of their hands. I put Zoe on the bed with us. I wanted to die, and I wanted my family together, not spread throughout the house. From there, I have little memory. Basically, I remember all the suicide attempts, yet another thing I sucked at, and picking up cheese, Benadryl, and galumpki. Stuffed cabbage, as I thought was sign for Meg. Supposedly, I had phone calls with people, text arguments with people. My family was looking for me, amongst other things.
We learned from the letter that Tony is aware that his relatives had looked for him in late December 2019 and early January 2020, the time the family was thought missing. He may have learned that from his sister in a phone call from jail, but we don't know because he didn't answer her question.
Did you know we were looking for you? It's okay.
I'm ashamed, and I ask for forgiveness and understanding from all.
Tony's account of the immediate aftermath of his family's deaths ends on page 20 of the letter. He then launches into a list of bullet points arguing his innocence, starting with an incident from when he was first in custody.
Other facts. After I was let to fall down the stairs, I was assisted the rest of the way to bottom where I encountered 3 voices. 1, we were looking to drop the charges, but we have to deal with this now, FBI. 2, we have a pod waiting for you with 4 other guys just like you. Police, and I didn't know what a pod was until March. And 3, which I thought was a UPS man. Why didn't you answer the door when we were knocking?
Tony makes an easily refutable claim here. He says authorities were looking to drop the healthcare fraud charges against him. That is not remotely the case. Federal agents went to Florida to arrest Tony, which led to the discovery of his family's bodies. Not even a month ago, U.S. Attorney John Durham in Connecticut filed a motion to dismiss the healthcare fraud complaint against Tony, but reserved the right to pursue the case in the future. The motion was filed so that the murder case in Florida wouldn't be slowed down by the healthcare fraud case.
Tony mentions something called a pod here. According to conversations he's had with his sister while he's been in jail, he's being held in a single cell that's part of a pod-style housing unit in the jail.
The last suicide attempt, I took 4 times the toxic dose of Benadryl, a lot, on Sunday, January 12, evening. How Benadryl works is it slows the body down, thus slowing the metabolism of it. As anything that raises the heart rate happens, the more is metabolized, hence the sparse memory.
Tony tries to explain his memory loss here, saying he thinks it was caused by Benadryl overdoses. He says he tried to commit suicide 8 times. According to the FDA, antihistamines like Benadryl can cause short-term memory loss. But without knowing how much Benadryl Tony actually took, we can't say for certain the effect it would have had on him.
At hospital, I was Baker acted and deemed not able to sign intake paperwork, but somehow I could waive my rights 1 hour after.
Police did say that Tony was taken to a hospital for an alleged suicide attempt. Tony says that when he arrived at the hospital, he was Baker acted. The Baker Act is a Florida law that allows people to be involuntarily admitted to a hospital for 72 hours for mental health issues. The act can be initiated by police officers or other law enforcement officials.
I was in need of a guardian to sign my discharge paperwork, but was able to sign away my Miranda rights 1 hour later. The interrogation was timed greater than 3 hours, but only 1 hour was recorded. I asked for my attorney at hospital when asked. Someone showed up and said to answer the questions asked, and he said he would meet up with me after DC. My two interviews are conflicting with each other and conflicted with medical examiner autopsies reports that was done in between. The officer states this in his DD-5, that he called the ME prior to the second interview, saying the report and my testimony did not show up. The second was more about my attempts than anything. I stated that I wanted to kill myself right then, during my second interview, and yet somehow sound mind. First interview, I told them Megan's father committed suicide in 2002-2003, but somehow they came down to assist after the miscarriage in 2019. We didn't deal with her mother since 2007.
Tony listing ways in which investigators mishandled his case reminded us of his father, Robert Tote. When we talked to Robert, he ran through a similar list of examples of police misconduct in his case, including mishandling evidence. He also detailed the many times he's appealed his case and the many lawsuits he's filed, just as Tony is plotting the many lawsuits he plans to file. We decided not to air a lot of Robert's claims in episode 5 because they couldn't be verified. Most of Tony's claims can't be verified either. He argues that he wasn't competent enough to give statements when first detained, which is when the police reportedly secured his confession. He also gives some insight into his legal strategy when he says his attorneys are planning on suppressing those statements.
The Medicaid fraud was and is BS. After I read the paperwork when they left, I found out the time frame was when Meg took over the billing. I told her not to worry when I saw her Friday night, and I would keep her name out of it, as they were only talking probation at worst. I didn't know the scope of billing mistakes, as my attorney said, to not discuss it. Also, the FBI had red flags because they found out I traveled, but on days I wasn't there. PTs were billed under me. That was the way the billing company set it up. All the therapists were credentialed, but we billed as a group, and I owned the group. In addition, they were insinuating some sort of money laundering scheme because no one does as much community service as you report. I told them to stick it up their asses because I actually did more anonymously, like donations to charities and help people with their rent, etc.
While we've been going through this letter, we keep thinking about how Tony has an answer for everything to the point that it became kind of jarring. Depending on whether you believe Tony's claims of innocence, the letter could read something like Tony wrote while considering, if the state were to cross-examine me, what are the holes they would try to poke in my story? When you start thinking like this, everything in the letter becomes a calculated detail, down to the ostensibly random tangents Tony goes on. Think about the foreshadowing we heard in multiple instances, like when he mentions Megan going over recipes on the day the family was killed, supposedly with the help of a Benadryl pudding pie. He needed a reason to be away from home, so he has an alibi, a home maintenance project, and a necklace to find. He has answers for why he didn't call for help, and he explains away why he was out of touch with authorities about the healthcare fraud investigation. He says he wasn't leaving Connecticut because of his legal trouble. Instead, he planned to head back to the state until, as he tells it, Megan had an episode about the world ending.
I was supposed to meet with the attorney the Wednesday after Thanksgiving and return to Florida for an early Thursday morning medical appointment for Meg. That was long awaited. I woke up Sunday morning to the smell of burning. It was Meg burning journal entries she had written about her aunt and uncle, as she didn't want them to read them, as she was saying the world was going to end and she was going to die, etc.
We heard about Megan's journals once before. In a phone call between Tony and his sister, while Tony is in jail and Chrissy is in Florida to gather some of the family's belongings.
Did you get my note?
I did, but I don't know where any of those journals are, and we're not going to be able to go into the house, it doesn't look like.
Why?
Because it's still being treated.
Chrissy tells her brother that she hasn't found Megan's journals yet. And Tony asks her to look in a dresser and a closet in the room where the bodies were found. But Chrissy says she isn't allowed to go into the house.
Tommy, I think tomorrow he'll be able to bring some stuff outside so at least we can look through. So I'll ask.
Okay, because they're in her dresser drawers.
Okay.
Both the condo and the thing. How's Cindy?
I went to the condo, Tony. They're not there.
Okay, then they were moved all to they're in her other dresser drawer in the master closet.
The crime scene photos we've been able to view include photos of a journal with Megan's name written on the inside cover, but they don't show what's written inside.
I canceled going back to Connecticut that week because of red flags and kept her under watch until we were to go to the medical appointment Thursday. I found out 11:30 p.m. Wednesday night that she had already canceled the appointment earlier in the week because she didn't want meds and no one could help. I then asked her to call one of the MDs in Gainesville, as we already moved Christmas to coincide with Tyler's birthday because of sickness, and we could visit a temple in Gainesville she wanted to go to, as we were heading there for Tyler's birthday dinner. I only remembered about the investigation of Medicaid fraud when they showed me the newspaper article you called The Current about. That was shown to me in March. It was the first time I learned that I was facing 1 to 2 years in jail if convicted. I was allowed to open fly to Florida and kept in contact with them over the phone. It was when I went silent because of the suicide attempt that they decided to come get me. I was described as psychotic on my arrival at jail by the head of mental health counseling, and I do not remember most of hospital time, none of the police station visit, or the first 5 to 7 days here in jail. Yet somehow I was competent to give statements. My attorneys made mincemeat of the prosecutor in our first pretrial last week, and now they are going after suppression of the statement. We have been limited due to coronavirus. They have scheduled pretrial for December 16, 2020, and trial for January, but my attorneys are going to move it up to October once they figure out how jury selection is going to work because of corona.
Tony says that he is expecting his trial to begin in October. It's now March of 2021, and his trial date was just set last month. It's scheduled to start on September 27th, nearly a year after he expected it to.
The main motive the prosecution is using is financial, and I just gave up. All BS. Meg took care of finances, and all I know is they were good. We had credit card debt that was budgeted and planned to be paid off from January 2020 to June 2020. And we had 2 business loans that were to be paid off in beginning of January and March. Other than that, we had the mortgage for condo at Wells Fargo. I only know username and password Meg handled. The house rental, we were evicted from for not paying December and January, obviously. Office rent the same as the house rental and payroll. To my understanding, all was paid through December. I didn't micromanage her, I trusted her. Even if we had financial problems, I have family that would help, and I wasn't opposed to working harder. I had to do so to finish paying college as my father lost his job. I never worried about that. I just worked harder and more. We had just invested money into rebuilding our website and marketing and was succeeding. In less than a month, we had record evals, new, scheduled, and the new staff I hired was full. I canceled going back that first week, as I told you, and then canceled the following week for the same, to tend to family. I was giving my schedulers a heart attack. I was off the last half of December already for the holiday and felt secure as our AR was over 250,000. No worries from what I knew, different from anyone else.
Tony says that everything was fine with their finances, as far as he knew. In reality, they were deep in debt, they were being evicted from their home, and Tony's businesses were crumbling. Public records show that the Totes and their businesses owed almost $100,000 in unpaid loans. Tony and his business had taken out loans or cash advances from more than 20 lenders. and one of his employees, Randy Gallagher, said there had been multiple times in recent years when Tony just didn't pay his employees or their checks bounced. Crime scene photos show opened letters from their electric company dating back to October, stating that they hadn't paid their bills, then that their checks had bounced, and warning that their power would be shut off. The Totes were being evicted from the house where the murders took place and had been sued by their landlord for failing to pay their rent. Tony says he didn't know about any of this and had no idea what a precarious financial situation they were in.
I hope that short letter answers most of questions, as it is just a summary, believe it or not. We had an amazing marriage, only hampered by her sickness, that I accepted with open arms, as I was determined to find a cure for her. Anyways, I sit here in protective isolative custody to protect my case and also for protection, as they say I'm not jail material. Writing, reading, self-PT, calling my sisters and Uncle Martin, outlining my next book, and doing a framework of a nonprofit. I am starting in memory of my family. MATZB 2019, alive and at peace, dedicated to providing resources and services to the chronically ill, not just heart disease and cancer. I also work my case daily. I'm looking forward to going home, whatever form and wherever that will be. I know I need to work on the name. So another reason I wrote is to offer forgiveness to you and extend a fragile olive branch. I don't know what kind of relationship I want with you, or any. Time will tell. I offer you forgiveness for not being there to protect us that night, March 19, 1980. Although we were both not there our respective nights in question, for different reasons, I cannot forgive myself if I don't first forgive you. The happenings of the night in 1980 are not mine to forgive, as I really don't know what happened and don't really care at this point. I haven't dealt with you because I had my independent views, formed by myself as I am allowed to as an adult, about the person you were and how I was shown off at the funeral of Aunt Gloria as a trophy, despite telling you I didn't wish to be ahead of time. I also thought you were a pompous, narcissistic ass, and I didn't want to have a relationship with you. There it was said. I am extending the fragile olive branch, and we will see. Don't burn it this time.
At the end of his letter, Tony literally writes that he's extending an olive branch to his father and that he's forgiven him for not being there the night that his mother, Loretta Tote, was shot. Notice that Tony does not say he forgives Robert for hiring someone to shoot his mother, which Robert was convicted of. It appears these two now have a mutual understanding. They both were gone the night of the crimes. They're both guilty about that, but they're also both genuinely innocent of what they've been accused of, as they say. We followed up with Robert several months after our interview in Hartford and after he had received the letter from Tony, and we found someone who mostly believed his son's claims.
He has said it over and over again. You know, I wasn't in the house even. You know, I was at the apartment. I'm like, okay, you know. And if everything went down the way you're saying it did, which I'm saying you're my son and I believe you, because I don't think you lie to me. You know, God sakes, I don't know how you're standing at this point, you know.
Robert said he and Tony had been in touch often beyond just the letter.
You know, as I told him when we first started talking, I really wouldn't know if I was going to meet him, if I was going to hug him or punch him out, you know, because there's that war going on, you know. There's a war going on inside of me all the time because of what happened to my ex-wife, you know. Same kind of situation. But is he frustrated? Yeah. I don't think there's a time that I've talked to him where he says, I just can't understand what I'm doing here. You know, I didn't do this. I said, you're preaching to the choir. You know what I mean?
In the letter, we hear Tony saying that Megan is becoming more spiritual or mystic in her beliefs, which provides a motive for her to commit the murders and strengthens his allegations against her. We hear him say that Megan is strong and controlling, and he is passive and almost subservient. We hear him reckon with his complicated relationship with his father, and we hear about the immediate aftermath of the murders. Of course, all of this information is from someone with their back against the wall, who has lied before, so you'll forgive our skepticism. We've spent a lot of time pointing out inconsistencies and questionable statements from Tony, and the sheer gall to say all of the crimes he's accused of belong to Megan is startling to say the least. But there are some parts of what Tony says that ring true. Chrissy knew in some way about Megan's visions of the end of the world, so that part did not come as a surprise. Tony's defense depends on a lot of factors, including whether his confession, reported by former Osceola County Sheriff Russ Gibson, is admissible in court. But the idea that Megan would for some reason believe so strongly in the world ending that she would kill their children to release their souls is now what his entire story hinges on. We haven't heard a motive for her killing the children other than this, whether in the letter or from anyone else.
This is between you and I. That is all. Do not share any info with Uncle Martin, Chrissy, or anyone else except Danielle. Not even that I wrote to you. I'm going to close for now, as I am in extreme pain, and I'm sure you're tired of reading. Please, if you correspond, watch what you write as they scan and send the news and prosecutor all my mail. Tony. P.S. The boys performed in Nashville, July 2019. I uploaded their performances in a recital to YouTube, if you want to see them. On YouTube, search Alec Tote and separately, Tyler Tote. They were amazing.
In our next episode, the season finale, we'll present all the loose ends we've gathered since beginning the reporting process back in January of 2020. We'll address some of the theories we've heard along the way. We'll look to Tony's future, and we'll remember how the untimely deaths of three children, a mother, and a dog impacted the people who were left behind.
If you or someone you know is in crisis, help is available. Call Mental Health America's crisis hotline at 1-800-273-TALK. If you haven't already, please subscribe to Looking for the Tote Family on your favorite podcast app. And don't forget to rate the show. Find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Looking for the Tote Family is hosted and reported by Taylor Hartz and Sten Spinella. Produced by Peter Huapi and Carlos Virgen. Written by Taylor Hartz, Sten Spinella, and Peter Huapi. Editing by Peter Huapi and music by Carlos Virgen. Tim Cotter is our executive editor. And Izaskun Larnieta is our managing editor. Social media management by interns Josette Moses and Allison O'Donnell. This has been a production of The Day in New London, Connecticut.